I'm David Schreiner Khan, and this is Smashing the Plateau. No matter how successful you are, there's probably at least one area where roadblocks are keeping you from fully achieving your goals. Fortunately, you've come to the right place. Every expert I interview on this podcast is different, but they all have one thing in common. They know how to fix problems that keep people stuck. Today, I'm pleased to welcome Akshay Nanavati. Akshay is a Marine Corps veteran, adventurer, and entrepreneur. After overcoming drug addiction, a diagnosis of PTSD after the war in Iraq, and a battle with alcohol that pushed him to the brink of suicide, Akshay has since explored the most hostile environments on the planet and built a global business helping people live limitless lifestyles. Combining years of research in neuroscience and psychology with his life experience, Akshay wrote the book Fearvana, the revolutionary science of how to turn fear into health, wealth, and happiness. His work funds his nonprofit, the Fearvana Foundation. It is the change-making arm of his lifelong mission to run across every country to create enduring peace one community at a time. Akshay, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me, David. Pleasure to be here.
You have a really fascinating background, Akshay, and I wonder if we could start off by talking about the trigger that enabled you to take control of the forces that were affecting your behavior.
Sure. You know, I think the biggest one was when I hit that breaking point after coming back from the war in Iraq. You know, I was diagnosed a few years later with PTSD, and I was drinking a lot, but I was one of those quote-unquote functioning alcoholics in the sense I still had my business, I was still running a lot, so things were kind of going well to some degree, but often I would go through these binge sessions where 5 days of just downing pints of vodka, and one time it finally hit me that I just thought that this pattern is never going to change, and what was the point of going on? And when that hit me, when that thought hit me, it really hit me hard. I mean, at that moment, I realized something really needed to change. And that's when I started researching neuroscience, psychology, spirituality, and realizing I got to find a way out of this. Like, there's no way I'm going to hit that low point ever again in my life. So that was a real trigger for me to finally say something's got to change. And I think pain is one of the strongest triggers we can find for creating long-lasting behavior change.
You know, it's interesting that you described your – I don't know if it's appropriate or not to call it a downward spiral, but at least what sounds like things getting worse and worse, that it wasn't like they catapulted downward in one instant. It was a progression.
Exactly. It really was. It was just, you know, I used to, like, for weeks I wouldn't drink. So it wasn't one of those things where I was drinking every day. It would just, certain triggers would lead to these long binge sessions. And I mean, next thing you know, a week of my life has disappeared in a blur. And I just hated that. I mean, life is too curious to be wasting it and to be losing a week like that. It was just shocking to me that I was doing that. And that's not who I wanted to be for myself or for the world around me. And finally, it hit a real low point that triggered a behavior change. I'm glad it happened because it eventually led me to where I am now. So no regrets, right?
Yeah. And, you know, these things in hindsight, they may seem terrible at the time and they may seem like we have no way out at the time. But when we do climb back up and find a solution where we're not engaging in that kind of behavior anymore, we realize that the path of going through that narrow space may have been needed in order to understand how to not repeat it and how to overcome it and how to deal
Absolutely.
With similar kinds of challenges in the future.
Exactly. I think we learn so much more from those. I mean, my greatest teachings have been, whether it be suffering through the war in Iraq or skiing across the second largest ice cap in the world for a month or climbing mountains in the Himalayas, it's through these hard moments, through these struggles, I've learned so much that teach you to handle anything that life throws your way. So they've been a true gift, and I can't regret it for sure.
So what has your journey been following the turnaround?
So since then, you know, I started doing that research, and for a while I had learned to moderate my drinking, and then that, you know, things were going even better. But once again, you know, like you said, like your podcast is called Smashing the Plateau, I feel like I hit a plateau. I got to a point in my life where I felt like, again, I was doing well. I was traveling the world, working from where I want, when I want. I mean, I was working while in, you know, yachting in the Caribbean or running through Luxembourg. So things were going great, happily married for 4 or 5 years. But But once again, I hit a point where suddenly it was actually, I remember exactly when it was. It was last Memorial Day. And I watched some war movies. Memorial Day, they show a lot of war movies. And it triggered me again. And once again, it led to this 5-day binge. And after that, I said, okay, you know what? Even the moderation thing is not going to work, not working for me. So I finally quit. I've sobered up. And at that point I was, you know, I had kept working on my book. My book took about 3 years to write. Part of it was research, but part of it was also that I was at this plateau level. And I realized that that's when I finally sobered up. And I said that, you know, I kept not finishing my book. I would always find a reason to postpone it, procrastinate. Ironically, I was writing about fear, but going through fear as well of writing it, you know, what are people going to think about the book? Is it going to be any good? And finally, when I sobered up, I almost rewrote the entire thing. I probably trashed about 100,000 words worth of work. But again, in hindsight, it's no regrets because what it's now turned out, and I finally finished it. I couldn't be happier with it. I've been getting great feedback. I was just honored and blessed. I mean, that His Holiness the Dalai Lama wrote the foreword for the book. So it's been really cool. I think that, you know, going through that point, and now I couldn't be in a better place. I mean, I'm running a 50-miler later this year. I've run a 50K last year. The book has been getting awesome feedback. I'm launching it this year. Business is going off. So it's just, I think, you know, this journey has always been a constant process of finding the problem, fixing the problem, and find what's working and do more of it. And I think mastery is nothing more than a combination of those two elements working together. And that's what I'm constantly doing. And that's what I'm currently doing as well, to kind of seek out the next stage of my evolution.
Yeah, the other thing that strikes me, Akshay, is that you're also doing it within self-imposed structure and behavior, which is something that is really key to the success of entrepreneurs and leaders. Yet it's something that may be somewhat counterintuitive, and it's really hard to do.
Mm-hmm. I absolutely agree, you know, and that's why I think it really is about sort of channeling that. I think restrictions and having those self-imposed structures are essential. And that was one of the challenges actually coming out of the Marines, because in the Marines, everything is a structure. I mean, you're told what to do in Iraq, you know, you wake up, life is very simple. And so that's part of the challenge of adjusting to life outside the Marines, and especially the entrepreneurial lifestyle where, I mean, you know, you work from home, you can theoretically just sit up, you know, watch TV all day. So you really have to channel and narrow your focus immensely. So, I mean, even with me, I'm constantly have a big picture vision, but everything is channeled and narrowed into the next immediate step, breaking it down to the smallest possible chunks and one step at a time. Okay, one step done, the next step. And I do that, whether it be in my business or in my training for running and for working out, everything is okay. What's the point of weakness? What do I need to address? And once I've addressed that, then what's the next one? So I'm always kind of, like I said, searching for that problem to quote unquote fix, and then working towards finding the next one, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Can you talk a little bit about what your routine is, like daily and weekly? Because it sounds like you have found a way to create this fabulous structure that addresses this, what sounds like very simple steps that you've identified. Right? Finding where the weak points are, addressing them, overcoming them, and moving on to the next one. And I suspect that your daily and weekly habits are probably key to that.
Absolutely. Yeah. Could not. I mean, and it's been a sort of process experimentation to figure out what works for me and what doesn't. And now I've gotten some pretty good systems. So one of the things that I always do is I've created checklists for everything. So as much as possible, the goal is to remove thinking and because when you think, it's cognitive energy, and cognitive energy, like any energy, is a valuable resource that you don't want to expend unless needed. So what I do is I create lists for everything. So that way, when I am saving my willpower or my cognitive energy, I have the ability to use it. So whether I'm, you know, okay, it's my 10-miler for the day or whatever it may be, that will take willpower sometimes. So I have to save my willpower for when I need it. Or writing, that takes effort. So for example, I have a morning ritual that I have listed out. So when I wake up in the morning, I don't have to think through what my ritual is. I just follow it step by step. And I can read it to you right now. It says, morning ritual, prayer, meditate, play wake up music. So I have a particular song I play to wake up, 25 push-ups, brush teeth, review goals and detailed plan for the day. So that's it. Once I follow that, that's my ritual. Then I go into, okay, that's next steps. And I know, so for example, my supplements, go for a morning run. And then I have a very specific set of actions. I learned this from Jack Canfield, one of my mentors, called the top five. So I have a list of five things that I need to get done during the day. And then I work in 1 hour to 1 hour, 15-minute shifts. And after that, I take a 10-minute break. So through some systems, I figured out, okay, what is effective for me for a strategy to take a break? What I like to do, this is not something everybody has to do, but what works for me is I like to watch some stand-up comedy. So I'll watch, you know, Louis C.K. or Bill Burr, maybe 5 to 10 minutes just to kind of laugh, take a little break. Sometimes I do some stretching, and then I'll go back into another shift of work. And I create these systems, and that's how I kind of go through my day. And what I do, so there's a degree of flexibility because I know certain tasks I needed to be done, but you know, and I work, break it into those chunks of work shifts, and then in the evening I give time for my family, and then I have a particular night ritual as well. So again, I have a checklist that I just follow before I go to sleep. So everything is very systematized to sort of remove that thinking as much as possible.
Yeah. Now, is this something that you think can work for other people the same way, or do you think each person needs to individualize it?
I think that the general idea can work for people the same way, but I think there's the degree of individualization comes in, for example, how long your work shift wants to be. So the Pomodoro technique says for 25 minutes with a 5-minute break. I didn't find that effective for me. 25 minutes just felt too short, and it was more distracting than anything else. So even when I skied across Greenland, for example, we used to ski in 1 hour to 1 hour, 15-minute shifts, and then take 10 minutes to drink some water, eat some food, and then go again. So it becomes this ritual you follow. So I've liked that for my work. And then, you know, I had to figure out what was an effective break for me. That was, again, a process of experimentation where I had to say, okay, what things work for me? And I actually have a list of recovery activities, or that's one for recovery. And then I have another one for work break activities. So for example, here's my list of work break activities: comedy skits, fun music, playing with my puppy, or fun connecting for no purpose at all with people. So just maybe, you know, giving a 5-minute call to a friend. So I have this, I've created again a checklist of, okay, here's my work break time. What works for me? And I created a checklist for that. So I recommend people kind of experimenting, figure out here's what works, here's what doesn't. Because initially work breaks activities used to kind of get carried away. And that's why I created a list. Okay, here I need some structure even with my breaks. And I found that these particular ones work very well for me to kind of take my mind off work and then be able to get back in the zone right after that. So in order to also have that, you know, that I set a timer for it. So I set a timer for an hour to hour, 15 minutes. And within that time, and again, there's a little bit of flexibility within that gap, because sometimes if it's an hour and I'm, you know, burning out with the writing and I notice myself kind of fall in terms of productivity, then I'll stop in an hour. Otherwise, I'll maybe go till hour 15. But it usually is within that gap that I do a work shift before I take a break.
Akshay, these are great tips. Let's talk a little bit about your book,
sure,
which is about turning fear into health, wealth, and happiness. So what is it that we can do to turn fear into something that is much more productive and effective for us?
The single most important thing, and this is kind of, it sounds simple, but it could not be more essential, is reframing how you view fear. Now, fear, when the word itself people hear, it doesn't have a positive connection, right? I mean, a positive association. People think of fear as a negative thing. And what happens when people hear, when we think of it as negative, is we try to avoid it. We, you know, people will say, you shouldn't be scared. Don't be afraid. You should know, let's be fearless. And that is the biggest problem. Like, I'll give you a small example with somebody I worked with. He kept saying that, you know, I just need to wait for the fear to go away so I can quit my job. And I told him, that's your problem. You're waiting for the fear to go away to quit your job. I said, it's natural to be scary. I mean, it's natural to be scared of quitting your job to starting a business. But when we demonize fear, when we make it out to be a negative, we actually then try to avoid it. We try to wait for it to go away to take action. Instead, it's about embracing that fear and saying, great, I am scared, and not judging the fear. Often what we do is, again, he was judging his fear. So he made that fear mean he was weak, because we see successful people all around us, right? We open up a social media thing and we see everybody's living a great life and we think, oh, awesome. Okay, that's what people, you know, these guys don't feel fear. These guys are awesome. But
don't look afraid in those pictures.
Exactly, right? Exactly. And that becomes the problem. So really the most important step is kind of what I like to say, falling in love with fear, saying that, I mean, the greatest things I've achieved in my life and were terrifying, including writing a book about fear. Throughout the process, I was nervous about, what are people going to think about this book? Is it going to be garbage? You know, am I going to get 1-star reviews on Amazon? All that kind of stuff. And I'm sure it's going to happen, but it's part of the process. So it's just, the first and most important step is really just breathing in that fear and saying it's okay. not judging your fears. And once you do, so many studies have shown that then you actually, you can change your biology. I mean, there's in the book, I talk about this chemical cocktail of nirvana. You know, you release chemicals like dopamine, adrenaline, anandamide. Anand is the Sanskrit word for bliss. So through fear, you actually literally create the state of bliss in your brain. So that forms with the belief that this fear can work for me. And when you say, okay, I'm going to make this fear work for me, it will work for you.
So how do you make fear work for you?
So once you kind of, quote, like, again, fall in love with fear, then it's about keeping your eye on the prize. So, okay, what's waiting for you on the other side of that fear? So, for example, it's, you know, from my book, it's the impact I want to make. We're giving away all the proceeds to charity. So not just through the content, but it's also through the money we want to raise. So the biggest thing, again, another thing that the problem that people make when they get caught up in their fears is not keeping their eye on the other side of their goal. So that's one step, is remember what you're working towards. One of the most important steps to is visualizing the struggle. You often hear with this sort of positive psychology movement is visualize yourself all happy and, you know, on the other side of your fears. But it's actually a lot more important to visualize yourself going through the fear. And they've done studies to show that works far more effectively. So, for example, even Michael Phelps, when he won the gold medal, you know, I mean, in all his races, what he does is he visualizes himself swimming. So in the 2008 Olympics, when his goggles flooded during the 200 meter butterfly, he actually didn't slow down one bit. And he kept swimming. And not only did he win the gold, but he broke the world record. So visualize yourself going through the struggle. That's a huge positive step. Another thing you can do is what I call find your fear allies. Those are things like creating a mastermind group, have support structures. There are also things like, it doesn't have to be people. It can even be like a vision board. So I surround myself with things around me to stay present to the vision that I want to create. And that could be creating the right songs. One thing I do is, in terms of music, is incredibly powerful. I've created a trigger. So I've created one particular song. Every time before I go work out, I play this song. And now what's happened is, my brain, like kind of like Pavlov's dogs, my brain has begun to associate that song with go mode. So, okay, let's say I have a 30-mile run planned. I know it's going to be painful. I know it's scary. Many of my workouts are terrifying because I know they're going to be miserable. But this trigger says to my brain, it's go time. So I also play this particular 3-minute song before starting a work schedule as well, because sometimes writing is challenging for me. So I play this, and my brain has learned to associate this song with go mode, just like Pavlov's dogs and the bells, right? So certain things like that. But, you know, so again, falling in love with fear and then being aware of your fears, like isolating yourself from your fears to understand it. So we're not just responding from our emotional point of view. We're saying, okay, what is going on with this fear? And then once you isolate yourself from the fear, then you can embrace it. Then you can harness it and say, okay, I am scared of, let's say, rock climbing. I mean, I remember a particular instance while I was rock climbing, I got really nervous. And ironically, the first climb, I kept saying, you know, stop being afraid. What's wrong with you? Why are you afraid? And then the first climb was awful. And the second climb, I said, wait a second, I'm writing a book about this. I should know better. And I literally just paused and said, okay, I'm not going to judge this fear. I'm just scared. Cool. And I just breathed in. I said, I'm going to be with this fear. I'm going to be fully present to this fear. And that second climb on a much harder route, I mean, it was like, you know, a ballet going up that wall. It was so graceful. So it's just choosing to isolate yourself from your fears, understanding it, breathing it in, visualizing. Those are some particular strategies that work really well.
And do you find that dealing with physical fear, like, I know you've spent a lot of time dealing with hostile environments. Do you think that dealing with having physical fear helps you deal with situations where there's a lot of fear, but it's not physical?
It definitely does, but it's also about exercising the awareness to make that connection. So, I mean, like, for example, writing a book was harder to me than, I mean, often I used to procrastinate on writing by going to run like a marathon. And people found that crazy. I had a few people like, wait, you're going to go run a marathon just for fun, as opposed to sitting on your couch working on a computer, right? But it was harder for me, that cognitive energy, the work of writing. So it's about saying, okay, how did I make this particular fear work for me in X scenario? And how can I translate it to this other scenario? So, in, you know, people think just because there's a risk of death that it might be scarier, but it's not always the case. It was scarier for me and harder for me to write than it was, you know, sometimes doing very dangerous things in hostile environments. So it's really about channeling what are the awareness, what are the triggers that are making this work, and how can I exercise it to in this particular scenario. And once again, the key most important thing you can do is not judge your fears. So however a fear shows up, don't beat yourself up for having it. Don't judge it. Just be with it and be okay with it. It doesn't matter what it may show up as. However it shows up, it's okay. Yeah, and no, then you can choose. Then you can use it.
That's really great advice. And Akshay, you mentioned that being in certain kinds of structures with other people can be helpful when you're in a mm-hmm. situation that involves fear. Like you mentioned masterminds. And I wondered if you could talk a little bit about what you found to be helpful to you in addressing challenging situations, particularly those that involve fear, with coaching, masterminds, etc.
I mean, my mastermind group is invaluable. So what I have is I learned the structure again from Jack Canfield. We have a group of six of us that we get on a call for about an hour once in 2 weeks. And what we do is we get on the call and initially we share for about 30 seconds each. And it has to be the key thing is it has to be very structured. So one person is a timer, because otherwise it becomes, you know, everybody's kind of talking and having fun and it loses the focus and then people no longer want to come on the call. So we have 30 seconds of sharing what's new and good in our lives since we last met. And then we have about 8 minutes of sharing what we need help with from the group. So each person gets about 8 minutes. And depending on sometimes the calls go an hour and a half, then we'll maybe give 10 minutes or whatever. So about 8 to 10 minutes, each person asks for a problem and then everybody offers input. And then we share for about 30 seconds to a minute at the end what action we're taking, what we promise to, what we commit to until the next session. So that's my mastermind group routine. So that's really valuable. Another thing I do is having a daily accountability buddy where all we do is we share our top five for the day. And then at the next day, we just say, did we do it or not? And you're not making excuses or why, you're just saying yes or no. And then it's funny how much if you find yourself saying, I did not get this done, the same thing for 5 days in a row, you kind of start to hate yourself for it. And then you say, okay, I better get it done today, you know? So it's a valuable structure to help you get that done. And with coaching, same thing. I've worked with the life coaches and business coaches in the past. And currently what I'm working with is an ultra marathoning coach. So you want to find a coach for the gap of where you want to be in terms of your next stage of your personal evolution. And so right now for me, it's choosing to do work with an ultra marathon coach, because that's what I want to, as I mentioned with the run around the world, I think that's the next step of my own, you know, growth that I'm choosing. So I work with that level of coach, but they're all invaluable structures, because we, no matter how self-aware we may be, we are all ultimately viewing the world from our own lens, which is, you know, tainted by our own life experience, our past, everything that's brought us to where we are today. So it's important to have outside structures to step outside of that lens to get some perspective from time to time.
Mm. And Akshay, when do you think it's appropriate to find an individual coach? And when do you think it's appropriate to find a peer support solution like a mastermind or accountability buddy?
I think both are always invaluable in my personal opinion. I think it's, you know, Jack Canfield works with a mastermind group at his level. So as you keep evolving, you'll find maybe a new group of to work within your mastermind group. And so I think it's no matter where you are in life, it's invaluable to have all of those structures, the coach, a mastermind group, an accountability buddy, all of it. It doesn't matter what sort of stage you are in your personal success. I find it to be very, very useful.
Is there a situation... Is there a kind of challenge that is more appropriate for a coach to address and a kind of challenge that's more appropriate for a peer support, either individual or group, to address?
In my personal experience, I found both to be – so, for example, my mastermind group was more directed towards – my work in the quote unquote expert industry. Because I mean, like let's say, for example, my ultra marathon, you know, having six ultra marathoners in a group might not be as valuable, because we're all going to essentially say somewhat the same thing. So having in that context, having my, you know, one ultra marathon coach is more effective. And so I think it's a matter of, I think it ultimately boils down to kind of figuring out an experimentation. What works? Like just thinking through it. Okay, what do I need this? So Marshall Goldsmith, who, you know, I think he's the number one leadership thinker in the world and the number one executive coach in the world. He works with top level players like CEO of Ford, of Walmart, of Alibaba. And at that point, you know, so these guys are all at the peak of their personal performance, and they work with a coach like Marshall, a one-person coach. And so I would assume also many of these guys have team structures as well. So I think it's just experimenting and figuring out, okay, what area of my life, maybe, for example, some of these guys might be struggling with family or work-life balance, as they say, you know, family stuff. So maybe that could be, okay, I want a coach for that, but maybe having a mastermind group in other areas like my professional life. So for me, as I said, for me, my business life, I find it more valuable currently to have a mastermind group. But for my physical improvement, I work with a one-on-one coach. So it's just a matter of stepping outside of yourself, exercising self-awareness in terms of what areas of my life do I want to work on, and which one would it be more valuable to have a sort of group structure versus a coach structure.
Got it. And have you ever been in a situation with either a coach or a group where it was a really bad fit and it just didn't work?
Yeah, we had some mastermind groups that it didn't kind of, same thing with coaches also. I've worked with coaches before that I didn't find it useful at all. And same thing with mastermind groups, because the problem before in the mastermind groups, and I don't sort of blame the individuals in the group, it was just a lack of structure. It ends up becoming, you know, casual conversations, and ultimately it just wasn't worth, it wasn't valuable in terms of the time. And so that's why it became really important to have these very, very stringent structures saying, okay, 30-second timer, once it beeps, we're moving on to the next person. So it ends up being of value. And same thing with coaches. I've had coaches in the past before that it was just kind of like, you know, I came on, we're having sort of conversations that are not getting me anywhere. So you would really have to have a coach that's willing to push you, that's willing to test you. And wherever you are in your personal evolution, there's Marshall Goldsmith says, I've seen in some of his interviews, that he only works with people at the top of their game. So if you're ready for the, you know, at that level of your game, then you maybe go work with the Marshall Goldsmith or something like that. So you just kind of have to look where you're at and then find that one person who's, you know, one step ahead of you. And then once you get to that next step, then look for the next person who's next, you know, ahead of you, and keep kind of evolving that way.
Sounds great.
If that makes sense.
Yep, absolutely. Okay, whom do you know personally who's been really successful at smashing plateaus?
The mentor that I've mentioned, he's awesome. He's amazing. Jack Canfield. You know, he was rejected from 144 publishers for Chickens of the Soul, kept going. And then even when he published the book, it was sort of not a big hit, but he kept taking 5 actions a day for 14 months and made Chickens of the Soul a New York Times bestseller. And now it's this monstrous, you know, phenomenon that I think is the most successful nonfiction book of all time, book series of all time. Then he wrote The Success Principles. Now he's created this Train the Trainer program where his goal is to have 1 million trainers around the world. So he keeps evolving and keeps growing, and it's really cool to see. I myself have done this Train the Trainer program. So he's a true master at his art and someone I highly admire, highly respect.
Yeah, one of the things that I'm hearing from this is that success is an iterative process, and breakthroughs happen after lots and lots of steps. We learn about breakthroughs that other people have when they gain notoriety, but typically it's after lots and lots of small steps and small pivots.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's immense struggle to get to, you know, like eventually when the book comes out, people think, oh, you have the book, it's amazing, and you know, all the success. But even for me personally, it's been a challenging road to get here. So we, like you said, we don't see those hard, small steps and the boring element of sitting there for hours on end, looking at your computer all night, and sometimes not a word comes out.
For sure. Well, congratulations on everything that you've achieved. And what's next for you? What do we have to look forward to in the near future?
The big step is the launch of my book, which I'm really, really excited about. That's kind of coming up here shortly. And then after that, next year, I want to get back to the running across the world. I'm going to be building out the nonprofit. And that's kind of next steps for next year, once hopefully the book reaches some success, and kind of leveraging that Fearvana brand to grow the Fearvana Foundation, grow the run. And Fearvana will eventually expand into a few other areas as well. For example, I'm building out a Fearvana Academy, which is an educational institution for the younger generation to teach them life skills, some of the things we're talking about that they don't learn in school. So Fearvana is kind of going to become this umbrella brand in many different verticals with the general category of being of enhancing well-being.
Sounds great. Well, Akshay, how can listeners learn more about you and follow you?
Fearvana.com. That's where you'll find me, find the book and everything from there. That's Fear, and then Vana, Vana, Fearvana.com.
Sounds great. Well, Akshay, thank you so much for taking the time to join us today on Smashing the Plateau. My guest today has been author, speaker, and explorer Akshay Nanavati. Thank you again, Akshay, for joining us.
Thank you for having me, David.
Thank you for listening to Smashing the Plateau, the podcast produced by 10 Strategic Partners. I hope you enjoyed our discussion. Have you ever hit a plateau in your own life or career? If so, let's talk. It would be my pleasure to take you through one of our free half-hour discovery sessions, where we'll get to the bottom of what might be keeping you stuck and how to move things forward. Just give me a call at 212-731-0770. That's 212-731-0770. 0770. You never know what you might find out.